You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Problems of Society, an Esoteric View, From Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future, 10 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 9, given in Zurich on the 27th of October, 1919. In speaking to a larger audience of the most important questions of our time, much will depend on whether or not we know something of the deeper powers at work in world historical developments, or, in other words, of the science of initiation, as we may call it. Nowadays, it is relatively easy to discuss contemporary issues based on all kinds of outward knowledge that one may consider to be scientific and practically useful. But it is extremely difficult to speak of these questions today, once one knows something about this science of initiation, and bases upon it, as one must, everything that we discuss on such occasions as this. Someone who addresses contemporary issues from the point of view of initiation science will be aware that he is opposed not only by the subjective opinions of most of those to whom he is speaking, but that a large portion of humanity today is in one way or another also subject to the very powerful and ever-growing influence of Ahrimanic forces at work in the world. However, I can only explain what I mean by this by offering you first a kind of historical overview of a large span of human history. From diverse reflections we have engaged in together here, and from various published lecture cycles, you will know that the middle of the 15th century marks the beginning of our current era as modern human beings. We have always referred to this period, starting around the mid-15th century, which is still basically in its infancy, as the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. It succeeded the previous era, which we reckon from the middle of the 8th century BC up to the middle of the 15th century. Looking still further back, we come to the Egyptian-Chaldean epoch. I mention this in passing, only to remind you of the larger context of our modern developments as we experience them. Now, as you know, the mystery of Golgotha occurred after the first third of the Greco-Roman epoch. We have described from many different perspectives what occurred through this mystery of Golgotha, and what significance it had for all human evolution, and in fact, for the whole evolution of the earth. Today I want to connect certain things relating to this mystery of Golgotha to this broader historical context. To do so, let us look back to much more ancient times, let us say, to around the beginning of the third millennium BC. As you know, outward historical records have very little to say about this early evolution of the human race on Earth. External documents point us to the Orient, to Asia. And from various anthroposophic reflections, you will know that the further back we look in humanity's evolution, the more different we find the human psyche, and that, in a sense, we find an ancient primordial wisdom underlying all human evolution at that time. You know that traditional wisdom was preserved within small secret circles until the 19th century, and then, albeit with little correspondence to the primordial wisdom of ancient traditions, until our own day. People today, who become acquainted with one or another aspect of this ancient primordial wisdom of humanity, are astonished at the depths of reality to which it points. At the same time, you will have seen from our reflections over the years that these widespread teachings of ancient times contrast radically with the outlooks of the ancient Hebrew peoples, the Jewish people, which are quite different in character. In a sense, therefore, it is valid to say that the former widespread primordial teachings are a heathen element contrasting with Hebrew and Jewish teachings. As you know from extant historical records and documents, the Christian element subsequently emerged from this Jewish tradition. From these historical facts, you can see something that I wish to consider today, that in the course of human evolution, it became necessary to oppose an ancient heathen element and its primordial wisdom with the Jewish element, from which Christianity at least partly later developed. In other words, this ancient heathen wisdom was not granted sole influence over humanity's further evolution. And this will lead us to ask why it was that this ancient primordial heathen wisdom, which in many respects can elicit our wonder, had to acquire a new shape, had to be transformed through Judaism and Christianity. This is a question we need to ask, but for initiation wisdom, it can be answered only by a very, very important fact, an occurrence in the Far East at the beginning of the 3rd millennium B.C. Looking back to these times in inward vision, the seer discovers there, too, the human incarnation of a supersensible being, like the incarnation of a supersensible being occurring through the mystery of Golgotha, when Christ entered the human being Jesus of Nazareth. The incarnation that occurred at the beginning of the 3rd millennium B.C. is extremely hard to perceive, even with the spiritual scientific vision made possible by initiation science. It endowed humankind with something extraordinarily luminous, extraordinarily incisive, basically that ancient primordial wisdom which I referred to. From an initially outward perspective, one can say that this influx of wisdom, deeply penetrating reality, was cold, intellectual, little colored by a content of feeling or sensibility. But that is an external appraisal. We can only inwardly judge the nature of this wisdom if we look back to the incarnation that occurred in the Far East, in Asia, at the start of the 3rd millennium B.C. Here, we discover by clairvoyant vision that the power of Lucifer did truly incarnate into humanity, and that this incarnation, accomplished in a certain way, gave rise to a primordial wisdom that spread amongst human culture in the third post-Atlantean epoch. What this Asiatic and Luciferic cultural impulse spread amongst humanity worked on into the ancient Greek era, a Luciferic wisdom that was certainly of benefit to humankind at that phase of evolution, and was in some ways illustrious. It manifests in a range of nuances, depending on the different peoples and races amongst whom it spread, clearly discernible throughout Asia and still apparent in Egyptian and Babylonian culture, but, as I said, also underlying the foundations of Greek culture. Everything that human beings could think, compose, and will at the time was in a sense determined by this Luciferic impetus in human culture. It would, of course, be extremely narrow-minded to say that since this was an incarnation of Lucifer, we should want nothing to do with it. Such Philistinism would lead us to flee all kinds of things of great beauty and grandeur that emerged in humanity from this Lucifer stream. As stated, the ideal of Greek beauty also arose from this developmental stream. At the time, the mystery of Golgotha unfolded, all Gnostic thinking and knowledge then existing was a penetrating wisdom that profoundly illumined the world and drew on the impulse of luciferic powers. We cannot therefore say that this Gnostic thinking was misguided. To say it was imbued with luciferic impulses is merely to characterize it. Now, 2 millennia, and a good deal more after this incarnation of Lucifer, came the mystery of Golgotha. And we can say that the thinking, feeling, and sensibilities of those amongst whom the impulse of the mystery of Golgotha spread were still fully endowed with the quality of this luciferic impulse. But now, a very different quality of impulse arose, that of Christ, and entered the evolutionary stream of civilization. We have spoken of its significance within humanity. Today I will just say in passing that the Christ impulse was absorbed by sensibilities of the kind I described. We can put it like this. The Christ impulse shone its light into the best of Lucifer's endowments to humanity. In the early Christian centuries, the Christ impulse was absorbed. The Christ was understood by virtue of what humankind had received from Lucifer. We have to be open-minded about these things. Otherwise, we will never properly understand the distinctive way in which the Christ impulse was absorbed in these early centuries. As the luciferic impulse increasingly faded from human sensibility, people grew ever less capable of fully absorbing the true nature of the Christ impulse. You need only consider the increasing materialism that prevailed as the modern era advanced. But if you ask what became most materialistic of all, you have to acknowledge that it was modern Christian theology. You see, a great part of modern Christian theology testifies to the greatest materialism. It no longer sees the Christ living in the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, but refers to him as, quote, the simple man of Nazareth, close quote, a figure more easily understood. The more people accepted the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, as an ordinary mortal, albeit one amongst the ranks of other renowned historical individuals, the more this pleased a certain materialistic school of modern theology, which wishes to have very little indeed to do with the supersensible nature of the Golgotha event. The luciferic influx into human sensibility gradually faded in the human soul, making way increasingly for what we call the Ahrimanic impulse, which will grow ever stronger in the near and also the further future. The Ahrimanic impulse derives from beings other than Christ or Lucifer, yet it is also a supersensible influx, and we could say a supersensible being, there is little distinction, whose influence will become especially powerful, ever more and more so, in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. If we consider the turbulence of recent years, we will find that it has been caused in particular by Ahrimanic powers. Like the incarnation of Lucifer at the beginning of the third millennium B.C., and the Christ incarnation at the time of the mystery of Golgotha, there will be an incarnation in the West of the being of Ahriman in the third millennium A.D., sometime after our current life on earth has ended. We only properly comprehend the course of history and human evolution over almost 6 millennia if we see it in these terms: a luciferic incarnation at one pole, the Christ incarnation in the middle of this period, and the incarnation of Ahriman at the other pole. Lucifer is the power in us which stirs up all quixotic and fervent powers, all false mysticism, all that seeks to elevate us arrogantly beyond our actual capacities. In a sense, it brings our blood into chaotic disorder in order to lift us out of ourselves. Ahriman, on the other hand, is the power that makes a person prosaic, hard-headed, Philistine, that ossifies us and persuades us of the illusory truth of materialism. Basically, our human nature is the effort to maintain equilibrium between the luciferic and the Ahrimanic power. And in modern times, the Christ impulse aids us in creating this balance or equilibrium. These two poles are always present in us, the luciferic and the Ahrimanic. But in historical terms, we find that the luciferic impulse predominated in certain streams of cultural evolution in the pre-Christian period and through into the early Christian centuries, whereas Ahriman has been active since the mid-15th century and is growing ever stronger until eventually an actual incarnation of Ahriman will occur within Western humanity. Now, it is intrinsic to such things that they are long prepared beforehand. Just as Lucifer once appeared in human form in China, and Christ Jesus appeared in human form in the Near East, so Ahrimanic powers are preparing human evolution in a way that will allow humanity to succumb to Ahriman when he eventually appears in human form in Western civilization, which will scarcely any longer be civilization as we know it. There is no use entertaining illusions about such things. Ahriman will appear in human form. All that will matter is the degree to which he finds humankind prepared for his arrival. Whether his preparations will enable him to enlist all humanity, all civilization as we know it, to follow his dictates, or whether he will find a humanity that can offer him resistance. Illusions are of no help here. Nowadays people try to evade the truth, and one cannot present it to them plain and unvarnished, because they would mock and ridicule such ideas. But nor can one present such things to them as I tried to do now in the form of the threefold social organism. The majority of them, at least, do not wish to hear about this either. In fact, this refusal to countenance such things is one of the means that Ahrimanic powers can employ to ensure that when Ahriman appears in human form, he will have the greatest possible number of adherents on earth. This refusal to engage with the most important truths will pave the way for Ahriman to thrive in his incarnation. You see, in seeking the right stance toward what will unfold in human evolution through Ahriman, nothing will help except an open-minded perception of the powers which Ahriman employs to act upon us, as well as the powers that can arm humanity against the temptations and ensnarements of Ahrimanic powers. Today, therefore, let us cast a look, at least from various perspectives, on the kinds of things that would consolidate people's adherence to Ahriman, and which now especially the Ahrimanic powers are sending down from supersensible worlds, sending also through human sensibilities, in order to secure as great a following as possible. One such means is to obstruct people's understanding of the importance for the human being of certain prevalent types of thinking. You know that there was a huge difference between the way a person felt in relation to the whole cosmos in, say, Egyptian times, and still in Greek times, and how he felt at the beginning of the modern era, after the medieval period had ended. If you imagine an ancient Egyptian fully versed in these things, he would have known that he is not only bodily constituted of substances found here on earth, manifest in the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, but that his being was informed by an influx of powers that he saw above in the stars. He felt himself to be part of the whole cosmos. He felt the whole cosmos to be not only animate, but also ensouled and spiritualized. And in his awareness there lived something of the spiritual entelechies of the cosmos, the soul nature of the cosmos, the life of the cosmos. All this was lost in the course of modern human history. Today the human being gazes up from his earth to the starry world, where he sees planets, stars, suns, comets, and so forth. But what means does he use to observe everything he sees up there in the cosmos, all that gazes down upon him? He uses mathematics, and at most also mechanical laws. Everything that encompasses the earth is now void of spirit, soul, and even life for him. The cosmos is now seen really as a great mechanical construct that can only be understood with the aid of mathematical and mechanical laws. Employing these laws, we understand it wonderfully well. This is not to say that a spiritual scientist will not fully value the achievements of Galileo, Kepler, and others. But what enters human comprehension and human awareness through the teachings of these great figures reveals the universe to be nothing but a vast mechanism. What this means for our view of reality can be seen only by someone able to trace the full scope of human nature. Astronomers and astrophysicists posit the universe as a mechanism that can be comprehended and calculated through mathematical formula, and a worldview such as this is one people can certainly credit from the moment they wake up in the morning to when they fall asleep again at night. But in the unconscious depths, people do not reach with their waking consciousness, but which belong to their existence nevertheless, and in which they live during sleep, a quite different sense of things, a different comprehension of the universe, flows into the human soul. A knowledge then lives within us that we are not consciously aware of, but that lives below, in the depths of our soul, and configures it. A knowledge of the spirit, of the life of the soul, of the life of the cosmos. And while people are unaware in their waking consciousness of what occurs in them, in community with the spirit, soul, and life of the universe, from the time they fall asleep to the moment they wake up, these things nevertheless live in the soul. Much of the split in modern human beings is caused by the disharmony between the soul's experience of the universe during sleep and its avowed view of the universe in waking awareness. The whole spirit and import of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science tells you that while Galileo and Copernicus introduced into humanity a view of the universe that is grandiose and mighty, this is not an absolute truth, but just one aspect of the cosmos, one way of looking at it. It is arrogant of modern humankind to say that the Ptolemaic system is childish, that people thought like this when humanity was still in its infancy. The idea that we have now attained some kind of absolute truth through our, quote, glorious advancements, close quote, is mistaken. This worldview is no more absolute than the Ptolemaic system was, just one perspective. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science can teach us that mere cosmic mathematics, all schemata of a mechanical nature, do not provide us with an absolute truth, but give us illusions about the cosmos. This is not to say that we do not need these illusions. They are intrinsic to the particular evolutionary stage we are passing through, and educative for us, as other views were intrinsic to other stages and educative. We have to appropriate them, but we must also know that they are illusory. and they become even more illusory when we carry them on into our everyday surroundings in atomistic teachings about matter, finding a kind of small-scale astronomy in molecular theory, in the nature of the Earth's substances. A true perspective on modern science, wherever it posits such things, will recognize that this is all founded on illusion. Ahriman, hoping that his incarnation will be as fruitful as possible for him, is most keenly interested in human beings perfecting this illusory science, which more or less accounts for all science today, but without them realizing that it is illusory. Ahriman has the very greatest interest in teaching people mathematics, but without them seeing that mathematical and mechanical views of the cosmos are mere illusion. He has the very greatest interest in teaching humanity chemistry, physics, biology, and so forth, which figure in our culture as greatly admired disciplines, but to make us believe, too, that they embody absolute truths rather than partial aspects. Photographs, if you like, from only one viewpoint. If you photograph a tree from one side only, it will give you a true, yet only a partial image. A fuller picture will emerge if you photograph it from four sides. Ahriman has the profoundest interest in concealing from humanity the fact that modern intellectual and rationalist science, with its credo of empiricism, is a great illusion. He would secure supreme, triumphant success if he could succeed in perpetuating into the third millennium these scientific superstitions so prevalent everywhere today, which even dictate the terms of social science. Born, then, as a human being, he would rejoice to find these scientific superstitions living within Western civilization. But do not draw the wrong conclusions from what I have now said. It would be mistaken to simply avoid and evade modern science. That would be the most misguided thing you could do. We should fully acquaint ourselves with it, but with full awareness that it offers us an illusory aspect, albeit necessary and educative for us at this stage of our evolution. We do not defend ourselves against Ahriman by avoiding modern science, but rather by acquainting ourselves with its true form and nature. This science inevitably gives us an outward illusion about the cosmos, and we need this. Please do not think that we do not need this outward illusion. But from a quite different angle and perspective, through spiritual research, we must fill it with true reality, advancing from its illusory character to the real truth. Numerous lecture cycles I have given emphasize what I am saying again today. I have always tried to engage fully with modern science, yet at the same time to lift it higher into the realm where we can perceive the extent to which it holds true. To wish away modern science is rather like wishing away a rainbow just because it is an illusion of light and color. To understand it fully, you will first have to comprehend its illusory character. And the same is true of all the ideas and concepts of the world which modern science offers. It offers only illusions, and we must see through them. By the very fact of penetrating these illusions, we educate ourselves to comprehend the world's reality. Keeping humankind locked in its scientific superstitions is one of the means employed by Ahriman to make his incarnation as effective as possible. The other means, a second means, is to encourage everything that divides people today, sunders them into small cliques and groupings at odds with one another. In the political arena, we can see this clearly today in all the parties and factions. If we study this phenomenon with an open mind, we can see that these parties feuding with each other cannot be explained by mere differences in human nature. You can't explain the Great War by referring to human disharmonies between different types of person, or differences of nation and race. Here it is very clear that non-sensory powers, aramanic powers, have been exerting their influence. And these aramanic powers are at work wherever disharmonies between groups of people arise. Let us take a very characteristic example to show what most of these things are based upon. Our modern proletariat now looks to Karl Marx. It is worth studying how the teachings of Karl Marx spread amongst the modern proletariat, and how they gave rise to a never-ending flood of Marxist literature. This literature fully embraces the scientific mode. Everything is rigorously supported with proof and evidence, so rigorously, in fact, that many one would have thought immune to Marxism have in fact succumbed to it. The fate of Marxism was to spread, first of all, through the proletariat, while academic institutions disputed and rejected it. Now there are a number of academics who can no longer resist the logic of Marxism, who acknowledge it and can no longer escape it, because Marxist literature, as has gradually become apparent, offers subtly congruent conclusions. With a modern scientific outlook and mode of thinking, the propositions of Marxism can be very nicely proven. The middle classes did not have their own Karl Marx to prove the opposite, but it would have been possible. You see, just as one can prove the ideological character of law and ethics, etc., and the theory of added value, and axioms of materialistic history from a Marxist perspective, so one could equally well prove exactly the opposite about all such things. It would be perfectly possible for a bourgeois Marx to prove exactly the opposite in the same rigorous way, without any distortion or underhand aims. Such evidence would certainly stand up. And this is because modern human thinking, the modern intellect, lies in a stratum of our being that prevents it reaching down to access realities. This is why one can prove one thing and then its opposite equally well, both with an equally rigorous procedure. Today it is possible with equally valid logic to prove the truth of spiritualism on the one hand and materialism on the other. These conflicting perspectives can feud with each other with equal right, because modern intellectualism lives in an upper stratum of reality and does not plumb the depths of existence. The same applies to partisan viewpoints of all kinds. If we do not comprehend this, but simply absorb such things through our upbringing, family, through the particular conditions we live in and the politics of the day, we may honestly believe our partisan view to be well-founded, and yet we have just fallen or slipped into it and find ourselves in conflict with people who have likewise slipped into their own partisan position. Both positions will be equally valid, and this brings chaos and confusion over humanity. The convulsions it causes will continually increase if humanity does not come to see this. And this confusion is something that aramanic powers employ, again, to prepare their triumphant incarnation, driving humankind ever more strongly into something it finds so difficult to comprehend. That one thing and its very opposite can be equally proven with the same well-founded intellectual or scientific reasoning. We have to recognize that anything can be proven, and it is in this light that we should see the proofs hammered out in modern academic discourse. Only in a science, in the strict meaning of the word, the strict study of phenomena, can realities become apparent. But in no other field should one allow merely intellectual proofs to hold sway. Human knowledge and perception must be sought at a deeper level, as in the practice of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, than in the stratum of our being where evidence and proof originates. And only then can we avoid the danger of succumbing to the Ahrimanic temptation that increasingly drags us down into these things. In our era, Ahriman also uses everything founded on genetics and inheritance to sow confusion and discord, although we have really grown beyond this now in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. The Ahrimanic power employs all that originates in heredity to set groups of human beings at odds with each other. Everything based on differences of family, race, and nation is used by the Ahrimanic powers to sow discord. It is a fine thing to preach freedom for every race and nation, even the smallest, but adversarial powers always employ fine words to sow confusion and to achieve the things that Ahriman wishes to for his incarnation. Who is it who incites nation against nation and invokes the kinds of issues that dominate humanity today? It is Ahriman, the Ahrimanic seduction influencing people. People are so easily deceived in this domain. They do not wish to descend to the deeper strata where realities exist. Ahriman is ably preparing for his aims. Since the Reformation and Renaissance, the prevailing view of the human being in modern culture has been that of, in quotes, economic man. And rulers have been those with economic power. You can trace this clearly in history. If you go further back in history to ancient times, even to the era I spoke of as Luciferic in character, the rulers were initiates. The Egyptian pharaohs, the Babylonian rulers, the rulers of Asia were initiates. Then the era of priests emerged, of priest kings, and they were dominant, basically, until the Reformation and Renaissance. Since then, economic man holds sway, and rulers are only the agents of economic factors. We must not think that modern rulers are anything other than the agents of economic man. And all the laws that have been created, it is worth studying this carefully, are simply a consequence of what economists have thought. Not until the 19th century do we see banking ideas and bankers replacing economic factors, and only then is the whole social order created, which overlays and hides all other social conditions, by means, really, of the money economy. It is just a question of seeing these things clearly and tracing them in an empirical, phenomenological way. Everything I said in my second public lecture here is profoundly true. We should study all the details of these things, and if we do so, we'll discover them to be thoroughly true. Specifically, as the dominance of a mere, quote, symbol for genuine goods, close quote, emerged, a major Ahrimanic deception surfaced with it. If we do not understand that we must counter economic man and the economic order established by bankers with a legislative state and the spiritual organism of society, Ahriman will once again find in this failure of perception a substantial means to prepare the triumph of his incarnation, which is certainly underway and will arrive. These are the kinds of means Ahriman can use, drawing on a certain type of person. However, there is also another type, though often both types are present in one and the same person, who helps to smooth his triumphant progress. You see, complete errors in real life are not actually as harmful as half and quarter truths. Things completely mistaken soon become apparent, while half and quarter truths seduce people. They live with them, and these partial truths worm their way into life and have the most devastating effects. There are people who do not recognize that the worldview of Galileo and Copernicus are partial truths, do not perceive their illusory nature, or find it too arduous to engage with them at all. We have shown already how misguided this is. But there are also people today, a great many of them, who acknowledge a certain half-truth, a very important one, and refuse to recognize that it is only true within certain limits. Just as it is partial and one-sided to acknowledge the world only as Galileo and Copernicus describe it, or, more generally, in terms of academic disciplines of a materialistic kind, so it is likewise one-sided to acknowledge the world only as it is presented in the Gospels, and to refuse any other approach to truth and reality. The Gospels were, of course, given to those who lived in the first centuries of Christianity. To believe, today, that the Gospels can give us the whole of Christianity is a half-truth, and therefore one that continually befuddles people, offering Ahriman the best means to achieve the goal, the triumphant conquest of his incarnation. There are a great many people nowadays who believe they are speaking in Christian humility when they say that they have no need of spiritual science. In fact, this is terrible arrogance. The simplicity and plain speaking of the Gospels, they say, leads them to the eternal truths humankind needs. It is usually, actually real arrogance that comes to expression in such seeming humility. And this proves very useful to Ahriman in the way I have suggested. Please, do not forget what I said at the start of today's reflections, that at the time when the Gospels were written, people's thinking, feeling, and vision, their whole way of seeing things, was imbued with a Luciferic quality. They were able to grasp the Gospels in terms of a kind of Luciferic gnosis. But nowadays, we can no longer grasp the Gospels in this ancient way. To hammer on about the Gospels as they have been handed down to us will no longer give us a real comprehension of Christ. A true view of Christ is in fact nowhere less forthcoming than in the diverse religious confessions. For us to come to a real understanding of Christ today, the Gospels need to be deepened through spiritual science. Here, it is interesting to study the separate Gospels carefully and fathom their true content. But just to take the Gospels at face value, as many people are nowadays taught to do, is not a path toward Christ, but a path away from Him. This is why the confessions are drifting ever further away from Christ. What view of Christ is found by someone who takes the Gospels at face value without deepening them through spiritual science? If he does really study the Gospels, he will ultimately arrive at a form of Christ, but one that falls far short of the reality, to which only spiritual science can lead us. The Gospels as they are lead to a correct view of Christ, in a sense. Yet this is only a kind of hallucination, a picture or vision, if you like, albeit a real inner one, but no more than a picture. We do not find Christ's reality by this means. And this is precisely the reason why modern theology has become so materialistic. Those who study the Gospels merely as theology arrive at the view that what can be gained from them is more or less the same as the conclusion they draw from Paul's Damascene experience. Wishing to establish Christianity, yet in fact undermining it, they state that Paul was sick, mentally ill, and this was why he had his vision at Damascus. The Gospels alone only enable us to form an hallucination, a vision. Through them we can gain an inwardly true picture, but not the reality of Christ. To reach the real Christ, we have to fathom everything that we can today gain from spirit knowledge of the world. This is why those who reject any kind of true spiritual knowledge and perception, and in their sectarian confessions hammer on the truth of the Gospels alone, are already forming the beginnings of a flock for Ahriman, when he appears in human form within modern civilization. They reject all spiritual exertions that lead to detailed and tangible perception, and their circles will therefore produce hosts of adherents to Ahriman's cause. These things are developing and are at work amongst modern humanity. Someone who speaks to humankind today, whether of social questions or other matters, with knowledge of initiation science, is speaking in this context and addressing this situation. He knows where the adversarial powers are at work, that they dwell above all in the supersensible realm, and that human beings, poor souls, are succumbing to them, are being led astray. His appeal to humanity will therefore be this: let us try to free ourselves from the grave temptations that seek to enlist us in establishing and consolidating the triumph of Ahriman. There are many who feel something along these lines, but there is not yet enough courage to fully engage, as anthroposophic spiritual science must, with Christ and the historical impulses of Lucifer and Ahriman in the thorough way that is needed. People sense the need for this, but they hold back from going far enough. Where today can we find recognition of the need to penetrate worldly, materialistic science and its Ahrimanic character with the Christ impulse? And on the other hand, to illumine the Gospels through spiritual scientific insights? How many people are really working to do both the one and the other through true spiritual scientific endeavors? Yet humanity will only gain the right stance toward Ahriman's earthly incarnation by comprehending these things, at the same time finding the courage, will, and energy to shine the Spirit into worldly science and to illumine the Gospels with this same Spirit. Otherwise, only half-truths will emerge. Think, for instance, of an enlightened figure such as Cardinal Neumann, who had clear vision of modern religious developments. When he was invested as cardinal in Rome, he openly stated in his address that to survive into the future, Christian Catholic teachings would need a new revelation. But we do not need a new revelation, for the age of revelations in the old sense has passed. Instead, we need a new science that is illumined by the Spirit. But people need the courage to engage with this new science. Think, for instance, of a literary series such as titled Lux Mundi, around the end of the 1880s, the beginning of the 1890s. Certain members of the English High Church, renowned theologians that belonged to it, sought to build bridges between worldly disciplines and religious dogma. But this amounted only to a tentative, tenuous effort rather than a keen grasp of worldly science, a real illumining of it by the Spirit, an open-minded study of the Gospels. Nowhere was it clearly stated that the Gospels alone are no longer enough, that they need illumining and clarifying. But that is what modern humanity needs, a two-pronged courage that says worldly science alone leads to illusion, and the Gospels alone lead to hallucination. We will only find a middle way between illusion and hallucination in a real, spiritually informed grasp of reality. That is what counts. It is important to penetrate these things with understanding. A merely worldly science would sow nothing but illusion amongst humanity, and would lead people eventually to accomplish nothing but idiocies. There is already enough stupidity in the world. The Great War was surely a great stupidity. Many of those involved in it were imbued with the outlooks of modern science. And if you look at the curious symptoms that appear when, for instance, some sect or other places unique emphasis on one of the four Gospels alone, you will more easily understand what I have said today about the Gospels. A sect that hearkens only to the Gospel of St. John, or another that does the same with the Gospel of St. Luke, tends strongly, as you can discover, to all kinds of hallucinatory symptoms. The one-sided nature of each Gospel, thank goodness, has not yet sown calamity, because there are four Gospels which outwardly contradict each other. Because there are four Gospels, people cannot succumb to the direction of one alone, cannot be drawn exclusively in that direction. One Sunday a priest will read from one of them, the next from another, and this mitigates the effect of each, complementing and modifying it with that of the others. There is great wisdom in the fact that these four Gospels have come down to us, so that, unlike many adherents of sects, we do not succumb to a single current that would overwhelm us if we studied only one Gospel alone. If we allow only one of the Gospels to work upon us, it becomes especially evident that this will ultimately lead to hallucinatory symptoms. Yes, we have to shed a good deal of our subjective inclinations, a good deal of what we feel naturally drawn to, which we consider to be pious or clever. Of primary importance today is for us to develop an all-round sense of the truth, and for this courage is required. That is what I wished to say to you today, so that you can realize that what we are trying to achieve within humanity does not have much deeper roots than merely subjective inclinations or prejudice. It is read from the signs of the times as something that must be undertaken. It has been a relatively long time since we met together here, and I was very concerned today to say what I now have. I hope that we will have a further opportunity to speak about such things again in the not-too-distant future. The end of Lecture 9.